the divine things. They felt, they sensed, they saw, whatever that means. They heard the presence of God and the voice of God. Now, if you heard the voice of God, if I was able, even much less, if I was able right now to summon a lightning bolt out of the clear blue sky to come down into the courtyard here, then you would be very much impressed, and you would be a fool to deny that I have tremendous power, right? Because here, look, I summoned the lightning bolt. So much more so, if it was a vast and very, very potent spectacle of God's existence and God's will and God's intent that the Jewish people should have a special mission. So that's why Chazal say that the Dor HaMidbar, the generation of the desert, was compelled to accept the Torah. What does it mean they were compelled to accept the Torah? Nobody stood over them with a whip until they said, not to Israel, we shall do and we shall hear. Rather, since they were confronted with absolute truth, at that moment they were like angels. Right? At that moment they were angels, and therefore they had, through the access to the divinity, they had no free will. Of course they could have chosen. They could have done something stupid, which they did later on, and, you know, and refused the Torah, or committed a sin. But a person who's sane at that moment, who doesn't want to deny truth, will concede the point, he'll be, so to speak, compelled to concede that God exists. So angels, when they're above, don't have free will, because not because they lack the capacity to have free will, but because they're in the presence of revelation. We, when we were above as Matan Torah, also lack free will because in the presence of revelation. Conversely, since we're normally below, and we are not in the presence of revelation, that's where we have the capacity to sin. So to angels, if they come below, they also get the capacity to sin. Yeah?
What is the truth that we don't see right now, if people don't see?
You see God. You hear God.
Why is it necessary to hear,
I see? Not necessary, but then if you don't see or hear God, you can choose to deny God or deny His agenda. Can you deny this to the table? You could, but then we'd lock you up in an insane asylum, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, I don't know if she will be the same. But if you deny it at the table, then I would see and say that you're insane or an idiot. But if you deny that there exists, let's say, that there exists, that if you deny that there exists, let's say, an electron. You know what electron is? It's an atom.
Right.
So, you know, that already, nobody's seen an electron. I can try and prove to you that you're wrong, and then hopefully you'll admit that there is an electron, but it's not so simple. Because you say to me, nobody's seen an electron, why do I know that that exists? Right? The same thing with God. God is like, so to speak, an electron. We can see, you know, electrons actually cannot be seen. They are, I believe, photons and neutrons, since they're much bigger. Not photons. What are they called? Protons. Are they protons? What are they called?
Protons.
Protons. Protons are like. Protons and neutrons, I think, can be seen. If I'm not mistaken, they're mistaken about that, too. But electrons are very, very tiny and cannot be seen, even with electron microscopes. Electron microscopes just record their presence, but they cannot be seen. In fact, the Heisenberg principle states that an electron cannot be seen because it is in nowhere. The moment you see it, it moves. Something like that. It's a very complex principle, but you can't predict where an electron is going to be, and if you would be able to predict where it could be, it wouldn't be there. Something like that. Anyway, I don't really understand it, but I know the uncertainty principle has something to do with that. So be that as it may, an electron leaves traces of what it is. Or, you know, it's also, you know, that's why they have these giant colliders, which miles and miles long, like Fermilab near Chicago, and they have this one in Switzerland, where they accelerate particles and try and get results which indicate what the subatomic particles are, but you can't see them. You can only see traces of them on a screen. Right? So God left traces of himself. The Bria, the creation, is a trace of God. But we don't see God. It's not the same thing like a table. At Mount Sinai, God was like the table. They're able to perceive whatever that means, because obviously God is not physical. But they sense the divine presence in a way which was undeniable. There was no possibility of denying it. After Torah was given, that there is constantly the possibility of denying the existence of God. Because who can prove the existence of God? So occasionally there are sparks, like Elio at Mount Carmel, when he was able to bring down, you know, the fire from heaven. So everybody said, oh, Hashem Elohim, God is certainly the Lord, because of this tremendous, amazing spectacle which Elio made. But that doesn't happen every day, not even every several hundred years. So therefore, it's not so simple to prove to oneself or to prove to others the existence of God, although it can be done. And therefore, it is possible to make mistakes. That is all because we're material. We're not material. We were just to have a neshama, like we say in the morning, a kind neshama shenasata b'tahorahi. Right? It's a pure thing. It's pure, meaning it doesn't have all the barriers, all the thick skin, literally, which prevents us from seeing God. So therefore, a malach who doesn't have that is able to perceive God in different aspects. Now, this is not the viewpoint of all great sages in Judaism. For instance, Rav Dessler, in a way which, in my humble opinion, is very, very full of contortions, says that malachim have no free will at all. As creatures, they don't have free will. In other words, it's not their situation which prevents them from having free will, it's their essence which prevents them from having free will. And therefore, he says, and this is where I think it's a little bit of a contortion, he says, hi, we find a chazal, or in the Chumash itself, allusions to sins of malachim. So he says, in that case, the malachim were sent to sin. That was their mission. The mission was to sin and to be punished, in order to teach us the concept of sin bringing to punishment. But they were pre-programmed to do so. It was not their free will. So I find that to be unnecessary, because a malach should be a malach. I don't see why a malach necessarily has to be sent to sin, you know, just to show us that sin is punished. We do that with human beings as well. And it seems to me that that's the Orson Matthews approach, is malachim don't sin only because their situation at normal times is probably more acceptable. Yes.
So the Midrash says that the malach came down and had relations with Ham's wife, and so that he, so it says to save face that he was with her on the ark. So that was the test, Ham.
I never heard that one before.
Okay.
What's the story?
So that Sichon was born by Ham's wife.
Oh yeah?
Okay, and that Amalek came down and was with her before, I think before they were on the Teva, and so, or maybe on the Teva, and so Ham was with his wife to save face, in the Teva, to save face. And so it said because that was perpetrated in the dark, that's why he was turned black.
Wow.
So why
is... Where did you hear this Midrash?
This is in the Midrash says.
Where did they get it from?
I'd have to check the source.
Seems
that was... I mean, it sounds like that was a test of Ham. Like, why?
No, it would be.
But the idea is that
according to Mishnah Melio, I guess. Yeah, I don't know what he would say. Yeah, the mouth was sent. He doesn't address that Midrash, otherwise I would have remembered. So I don't know what he does with that Midrash, but obviously he didn't have the Midrash set, so he didn't have access to all these obscure drushes. So, but obviously then he would have to find some way, yes, in which the Malach was sent to do this in order to bring about some sort of, you know, end. Not necessarily in order to prove that sins are punished, but some other end. Maybe that Sichon many years later would be, you know, opposed by the Jews when they're entering the land of Israel. There would have to be some reason for it.
How does Rav
Dessler
deal with the
Nephilim? The Nephilim, yeah. So he said that they were sent. He would say that they were sent. They were sent in order to propagate this super race, in order to that this race should have the potential of achieving great spiritual height, which of course they must mess up in doing, and therefore the Mabul came and took them all away.
But they were supposed to be Malachim first, right? I mean, so does he say that they were Malachim who had no free will and then they were sent and they received free will, or...?
No, I think they were sent to cohabit with women, human women, in order to lose that race. I don't know what happened afterwards to Malachim. I don't know necessarily that they stayed below. Maybe like in his case, the Malach came down, right, conceived children, and went up back up to Shemayim.
That was his mission.
Right, that was his mission. It's a very, to me, it sounds, you know, you're asking me to defend a position which I don't find tenable. But that's what I guess I would say for those circumstances. Okay, so to bear in mind, this is a little bit of a tangent, as I said, the Artemeth is really dealing with the general question of Bechira and how we deal with our free will at the same time with God's foreknowledge. Now I'm going to skip down to the next paragraph. We now pi Torah, based on the Torah, ain shum svara chalila, there is no logic, God heaven forfend, v'achisha b'chira b'miksas min ha-miksas. He says you can't deny free will. V'im kein ein tzchar v'onish, because if this is so, there's no reward and punishment. Now the Ursa Math here is being a Maimonidean, and seeing that free will and reward and punishment are naturally contingent on each other. We saw, and on the first page of the handout, that Rabbeinu Kreskas held that there's not necessarily. And Rabbeinu Kreskas is in essence similar to Rav Zetzler, right? He holds that, you know, you're going to sin and you're going to be punished. That's the way it is. You know, punishment is the natural result of a sin, and the sin may well have been determined, or the good deed being determined, and it's not really that you're being punished, but rather the consequences of the sin are visited upon you. So he has a different understanding of reward and punishment than our conventional understanding. Our conventional understanding is that you get rewarded if you do something good out of your own volition. And you get punished if you do something bad out of your own volition. But he's saying, Rabbeinu Kreskas, not like that. And the Ratzemach, of course, denies that here. He says it can't be. True reward and punishment, by definition, he says, are contingent on there being free will. So therefore, we can't deny free will. There's no reward and punishment. There's no point in commandments. Both 613 commandments are irrelevant. If everybody's pre-programmed to do what they're going to do, why need commandments? Commandments are necessary when somebody doesn't know what to do, when he has free will. So I have to tell him, choose this. Choose life. Right? But if he's pre-programmed to choose chayim or mavet, life or death, what's the Torah all about? What is the Torah commanding an individual? So therefore, it seems evident from the fact that there's a Torah, right? So there must be free will. Yeah.
Are you saying, or he's saying that the God knowing what we will do is denies free will? I don't think so.
Excuse me?
Is he saying, but that God knows what I will do to next moment is does not negate my free will?
He hasn't explained why not yet.
Okay.
He's trying to get to that. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I was...
And he has all, again, he goes further into this, and he talks about the sages who we saw hold that God doesn't know everything, and that's why there's free will, and he denies that. And then he gets to the more, if we turn the page, he gets more deeper into his understanding, right? And he brings down, on the next page, he brings up the Maharal. You see, those of you who have the handout, he says the word Ba'atik, possess. So he says, I'm going to copy here, David Rabbeinu Hamafursam, the words of our famous rabbi, Maharal Rav Levomi Prague. That's Rabbi Loewy from Prague, who's famous as the Maharal. But he wrote strong words, but he wrote Gvuros Hashem in his book Gvuros Hashem, Bakdoma in his introduction. The Gvuros Hashem is the Maharal's work about the Exodus. It's a whole work about Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's what it's all about. As a matter of fact, there's a Agada of the Maharal, which is the, synopsis is not the right word, an abridgment of his work of Gvuros Hashem. Brings down, you know, in short, certain things, not very short, it's quite long as I got it, but it brings down a shorter form of things he wrote in the writing of Gvuros Hashem. So, about Domazel Shono, about Sagota la Rabbad. Now, the Rabbad we saw. The Rabbad holds that God doesn't know everything, right? He knows the general in advance. Because if he knew everything in advance, then we would have no free will. He knows the generalities. That's what the Rambam says. He knows the generalities. He knows the general trends of what's going to happen, but not where each person necessarily is going to fit into that trend. That's the Rambam. So the Or Sameach writes in his brackets here, Asher be'emet bodi berkein Rambam. The truth is, Rambam does not say that. If you boil it for Nadu, he'll explain later on how to understand the Rambam. But he says, but in any event, Moshe, going back to what the Maharal says, Va'anachnu, we, Talmidei Moshe Olav HaShalom, the students of Moshe, I don't know if he's referring to Moshe Rabbeinu, or to Moshe Ben Maimon, the Rambam, because really the Rambam says that God knows everything. We can't accept this. Avu hu yisbar shikru Chazal, but he, the Blessed One, which Chazal said, call him B'shem HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But in that name, by the way, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the name is really HaKadosh. That's what we're calling God in that term. HaKadosh, the Holy One. The Blessed Be He is like whenever we say a bracha, there's a custom to say Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo, right? Which is not part of God's name, but rather it's a praise which is rendered unto God because we mention His name. So with that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it sounds like it's all part of the name, but rather HaKadosh. We stress that He's the Holy One, right? Once you mention the Holy One, blessed is the Holy One, right? But the name itself is HaKadosh. So therefore, why don't we say, he says, V'lo nikro HaSeichel Baruch Hu, right? Why don't we call Him the ultimate intellect? Right? We call Him the ultimate intellect. Now, again, the Rasmach intervenes here with his comment. B'zed Vorem Ne'imi. In this, His words are pleasant. Ki cholila ein boris bach shum torei chiyuvi. Because, chas v'sholom, we can't give to God any positive description. We said that very early in this process. We can't still give any God any positive description. Kasher herich bebitol zeh, as he spent a long time explaining, b'hamore v'stopa, the Rambam, correctly. Ki be'emet eno musa klal. But he can't, Hashem can't be grasped. They don't need that call. He can't be defined. The Imam Tuar Bechiyu, were we to be able to define in a positive way, Hayom Musad Moso, that we could grasp His essence. Right. So all we can say, Rak Ta'ara Bishlila, all we can say is negate that what He's not. And that's why, in fact, we say, Zeh Kadosh. That's how we say He's Kadosh. Hanushu Mufrash. What Kadosh is set aside. Who mufrash mikol ha'tarim? He's set aside from any description. He's removed. There's no way to define Him, right? When we call ourselves and from any perception, v'zehu rashem kadosh. That's how you call Him kadosh. Now that's Lord Tamir, and that really would make sense according to what we've learned. But the Maharal gives a different answer. It says ki amitas atzmo lo noda. No, really, it's the same thing actually. Lord Tamir is explaining the Maharal. Ki amitas atzmo, because the truth of what God is, lo no da, we don't know. Rakshuhuni dao, we only know these separate, mikol geshem gu, from any physical existence in any body, mikol nim soim, from anything which exists in the world. Val zen emar kadosh baruch hu, that's what we call kadosh. Shem yon kadosh, because the concept of holy, nemar, is stated, amishu nidao, somebody who's separated. Somebody who's separated in some way, shape, or form from the rest of humanity, from the rest of the animals of the world, right? An animal can have kedusha too. From the rest of the vegetation of the world, we know vegetation can have kedusha when it's made into a mincha. So anything which is separated from other people, animals, vegetables, even stones, right? If you build a Beis HaMikdash out of stone, they become kadosh. They are separated from other types of natural occurrences. Yes.
But if you separate Hashem from these things, then you're limiting Hashem. That's what we said, that Hashem isn't everywhere, He's nowhere. This is, if you separate Him from humanity, that means...
Yeah, but not separating Him in a way which means that he's severed from humanity. But meaning that He's in a separate dimension from humanity. That's exactly the point.
But that means if He's not in this dimension, that means He's limited.
You want to go, you call it limited? This is the dimension of imperfection. If God would be present in this dimension, He'd be imperfect. By definition, He has to, in other dimensions, the dimension of perfection. There is nothing perfect in this world.
Right. But to be excluded from this world means that you're excluded.
No, you're thinking of it the wrong way. Where, no, I think.
I'm not sure.
Far be it from me to choose to see it the wrong way. But, the way I'm
trying to take in everything we've, we've talked about.
The way Rav Noach Weinberg...
You're wrong.
The way Rav Noach Weinberg puts on one of his tapes is that God can't catch a cold. God can't break his leg.
Right.
God can't create a rock he can't lift. Is that means that God is limited? No, the definition of a perfect entity is something which cannot catch a cold. So if there was something like a perfectly healthy human being, he would never catch a cold. But there is no such thing as a perfectly healthy human being. So it's not, it would be a limitation were he able to catch a cold. Right? The fact that he can't catch a cold
is
a manifestation of his perfection.
Okay.
Okay? Now, if you're a good enough philosopher, I've encountered them, you could refute my argument. But obviously you're not, and therefore I'm safe. Okay. But they do have reputations for that. But that's a simple understanding of what it's about. So he says, again, the Kodesh is something which is separate. Mizeh ba'atmo, and that really what the Rosh meant about, the Miles about the same thing I just said to you. Mizeh ba'atmo, and from this very reason, shubetachlis hapshitus. He's the ultimate simplicity. Meaning he's not made up of any moving parts. You want to know where we are?
Right.
Since he has no moving parts, right, he's the ultimate oneness, ain't of our need dummy menu. There's nothing which is really separate from him. You see, he's separate from us, but we're not separate from him, right? Because he exists in a different dimension which transcends all of our existences. A thing which has a specific definition, right? And is special in some specific way, we should also gather, because of that specific definition, nivdami menu davar she'eino begidro. Something which is not within that definition is separated from it, right? In other words, if I speak about fruit, then fruit includes apples, oranges, peaches, pears, and so on and so forth. The moment I set up a further definition, right, which is I define apples, so that array doesn't include pears, right? If I define citrus fruit, it could still include oranges, lemons, limes, and so on and so forth, but it doesn't include apples, right? But the broader, the less defined a thing is, the more inclusive it is. If something is completely beyond definition, it includes everything. Was that an amazing statement? I would never have phrased it that way, but it's pretty cool. If we were able to find God, that would limit him, and there'd be something separate from him. But something which is an all-encompassing category, meaning it defies definition, is something which, by definition, includes everything. So yes, because he is nowhere, he cannot be defined as nowhere, therefore he is everywhere, so to speak. Okay? Because he's simple. Vein lo geter klal, he has no definition. Ain't avon nivdal mimenu. There's nothing separate from him. That's why he's omniscient, he knows everything, and omnipotent, all powerful. So his contention is, by virtue of the fact that Hashem is beyond definition, he's even beyond the definition of perfection, right? Because if you either define him as perfect, then it's already definition. So maybe he doesn't include all those things which are imperfect, right? Like I said, in other words, he has no access to them. No, because he's beyond definition. He knows everything, even about those things which are imperfect. Because everything, including all knowledge of all sorts, from beginning to end, is all within HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak. Not within him in the sense that you're God, and God is you. But rather, it all takes place within that tremendously broad, undefinable, infinite, which is Hashem. Right? It's a very powerful... very powerful definition. It's actually kind of difficult to conceive of, but that's the way he thinks. He says the chosay again. He stresses me nation ain't lo geder miuchad. There's no specific definition. Sheyukdar b'zeh that he can define it. V'yizbarach yodei hakol. That's why Hashem, blessed be He, knows hakol, everything, b'chokhmoso, in His wisdom, upolal hakol b'chokhmoso, and He knows activates everything with His strength. Ki ein chiluk, there is no distinction, ben asara shumatik hanimtzayim, in between the perception with which he perceives those things which exist, or mashu polel shar pulos, and that which he does other things. So it's a fascinating thing which he says. The Maharal actually says that the omnipotence is all-powerfulness, and the omniscience is all-knowingness, all stem from this idea that he's beyond definition. Because that which is beyond definition, in other words, the same thing with strength, right? The moment I define your strength, I'm limiting you, right? I say, you know, well, you are as strong as Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? So that's pretty strong, but that means you're not stronger than Arnold Schwarzenegger. Then on the other hand, I could say that you're as strong as Beckhoffer, which means you're pretty weak. But there are very various definitions of strength. But the more of a bodybuilder you are, the more of a weightless you are, the more powerful you are, the more you can do things, you know, lift up various gradations of weight. You don't just get up to here, but you get up to here. But God is beyond those definitions. So therefore, he can lift up any weight, so to speak. There's nothing which he cannot do, because he transcends definition. Again, when something which is defined is limited. Something which is not defined is unlimited. So that's the way he explains the situation. So he goes on to say that as a result, the Maharal goes on to say that as a result, it shouldn't be astounding that God knows everything. It's not, because that's a function of being God. Function of being God is that he transcends everything because it's beyond definition. That beyond definition means every possible definition is within his definition, and he transcends that. So therefore he must know everything, and he must be all-powerful. Okay, let's get to the next paragraph. Right? Udvarav tmuyim lemareinim. His words are astonishing when we see them with our eyes. She'arich lo'amik, which he speaks a great depth. Ki im nomar, if we say, ki ha'yidiyo mitchadeshes eslo, if we say that he gets new knowledge, ein zeh shinui bo, it doesn't change him, rakitiyas pulo mi'ito, it's just a function of his activity, moshneama shabori kora hayon, just like we say that the Creator split open the sea, and v'chatos ha'layla, in the middle of the night, he called b'chayri, he smote all the firstborns in Egypt. Ain't shinui b'zeh, doesn't change him. These are all things which are part of his being. They don't reach the definition or change the definition of God because it's beyond definition. Kachim nomar, so too if we know, say, shabori yadav, that if he knew shamitrim inus b'nei Yisrael, he knew that the Egyptians were going to afflict the Jews, right? B'shah she'inu, at the time that they afflicted, and the shinui bo. Doesn't matter, because again, all these things are part of his encompassing beyond definition. This is the synopsis of his long words. B'chayi roshi, by the life of my head, b'roshi devorah, when I saw him, or Smeach says, when I saw the Maharal, nishtomati, I was astonished. Ki b'mchila tvodo, asking leave of his honor, nira hakoshi ha'godo b'tvodo. We can see a great difficulty in his words, asher l'dayti osur l'aymra. So he says it's forbidden to say like the Maharal. We just saw the Maharal is so beautiful, right? He says it's forbidden to say like the Maharal. Well, why is that? Tine? Because, im nomar sh'abor yizbarach oseh p'ula, if we say that when a God does something, ain't the atzio me'ito, it's not the same way of doing from his side, kasher ya'aseh adam, like a person does davar v'tznuat nasho, like a person does in the way, you know, that he activates his own soul, uvaimalo sichlo me'amasezos cholila, and I'm not sure exactly what it means that, but when his brain becomes filled with this deed, I guess that the what he means is like this, that if I do something, then I'm completely focused on that, right? And I can't focus on something else at the same time. My brain is filled, right? So obviously God's brain is not filled, right? Because, so the Maharal says, why is that? Because, again, he's not defined, right? Rak barot Hashem yitzadakol, because everything comes, everything happens as a result of the will of God. B'neinirem me'ezem akom yitzaveh shinui. So therefore, where is there a difference created in the world? Imi gavra hanifal, if it's from something which is done in this world, hello davar nifal enas musa yisbarach, that thing which occurs is not God, right? This tape recorder is not God, right? Is that clear? If I make a tape recorder, I'm not making something God. It might be a divine tape recorder because it's recording a shir, but it's not God, right? That's the use of, and and if that which makes the difference is that which the person goes to do the deed, this of course has nothing to do with the Hashem. Because he doesn't need to move at all. He makes these things from nothingness, but it's not possible with a simple will. Always speak about his mirror. So no, the chot of idioso. We speak about his will, his capacity, and his awareness. Nomar, ki cholila nomar shuhu rotze bizman. O yochol ze bizman, ze cholila de cholila. He says, we can't say that he wants something at some time, or can do something at this sometime, because that would mean that at other times he doesn't want something, or at other times he can't do something. So how do we understand if God, the way Maharal explains that God encompasses everything, it still means that God sometimes wants and sometimes doesn't want. God sometimes does and doesn't do, right? So therefore, by definition, God is changing, right? Which is one of the problems we had at the beginning of our discussion. If God knows everything and does everything, by virtue of his transcending everything, but things are happening which are not him, so he's changing. He's changing in his awareness. And the things are changing in things in his will. Because sometimes he likes us, sometimes he doesn't like us, right? Sometimes he grants us favors, sometimes he doesn't grant us favors. So what's going on? It would seem that God is changing, right? It's changing, changes in God.
No, not really.
Why not?
Because...
I mean, he's obviously going to say it. Yeah, go on. All right. So, ubezet of ino evdel, and with this you understand this difference between even the marsh you there achshav, repol achshav. I skipped. Raku kadmon b'idioso, rather he is ancient in his awareness, uritzono and his will, uvichoto and its capacity. Kekadmuso yizborach, because God is ancient. What does it mean God is ancient? The tomid haya etlo b'yotzono hakadum. He always had in his ancient will. Lios b'yotzono kach b'zmana mitziyon manibroin. That this should be, I'm pretty sure is what you're going to say. That things should happen this way at that time through his created entities. In other words, the key point which the Rambam has made here, which we mentioned at the beginning of this discussion, is that the best answer we have is that God transcends time. Not he transcends everything which occurs, right? But he transcends time. So for example, if I have a person, just to give a muscle, analogy, you have a pyramid, right? And you have people who are standing down here below, right? So they all can only see their limited, they can only see their limited perspective, right? Which is occurring at that, which is their space where they are at that time. But if you have the person who's at the top of the pyramid over here, he can see everything at once, simultaneously, right? Now, that's not the way God is. Because God is not seeing things simultaneously. That would be still implying time. What means is that since everything which occurs was in God's eternal will. But God's eternity is not our eternity. It means that when he says ancient, atik, it doesn't mean ancient literally, but rather in the way that God transcends time, his will, whatever occurs at any time, was in his will. Again, I have to use the word of like it's not true forever, right? There is no change in God's will because his will, as unpacked in the creation, is by definition the will he always had. And his will in creating the creation and in running the creation was always his will. And that's why to a certain extent I understand, you know, according to the opinions that the world is literally 6,000 years old. Right? We have a different interpretation, not really 6,000 years old, but it seems to us a very, God is infinite, right? 6,000 years is a small time, right? So why do you make such a short world? Right? So the answer is, God is not infinite in that sense. The 6,000 years don't take place anyway before him in a different way that we experience it, because he transcends time. So therefore, the things which occur are not things which occur necessarily in the short period of 6,000 years. From our perspective, being in time, the short period of 6,000 years. From God's perspective, it doesn't matter anyway how much time it is, because he's not susceptible to time. Does that make any sense? Is it clear at all? Not at all?
How can we conceive that the concept of no time?
We can't.
That's the question.
That's wrong. We can't conceive the concept of no time. Right. Well, we can conceive, we can bring an analogy from space to time, but we can't conceive of no time. But we can say, speak about space, you know, somebody perceiving more space. But we can't perceive of somebody seeing all time at once. So it's hard to explain, but that's really what the Orson Man is saying. I'll come back to it tomorrow and we'll finish up.
Okay.